Okay. All right. I'm going to call to order the task force class size meeting today. I want to thank everybody who's on the phone. And can we get a sort of a roll call on who's here on the phone?
Brittany Pickleton.
Jessica Klassen.
And Matsumoto.
Okay. Is there one more?
Oh, that might have been me when I called in as a host. Okay. When it said all four, right. It'll count the host.
Okay. Thank you for being here, both in the room and on the phone. And we have some presentations that we're going to start with today. And those presentations, we're going to switch them because of some speaker responsibilities in other places. So we are going to start with Oregon Rising. And today we have with us Craig Hawkins, who's the Executive Director of the Confederation of Oregon Schools Administrators. And he's going to be giving us a little bit more information about this report. So, Craig, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Representative McLean. It's a pleasure to be here. And I really appreciate the opportunity to talk a little bit about Oregon Rising.
Thank you.
So, you know, Darren Drill, who's sitting to my left, was actually in the room when the concept for Oregon Rising was conceived about 18 months ago. And very quickly after that meeting, our partners at OEA and OESBA joined in the Oregon Rising effort. And Oregon Rising was designed all about hearing what Oregonians' hopes and dreams are for students and for schools. That's really what we wanted to do. It was a very simple in that sense, but what we learned is it was a very robust conversation with Oregonians. So last spring, the three organizations came together and designed a process where we asked Oregonians to describe the education they want for their children, their grandchildren, and the children next door. And so we scheduled meetings around the state. We set up a website, which, by the way, for those on the phone, if you go to oregon-rising.org, you can see that work right there. And we talked to Oregonians, engaged Oregonians in every county and among all demographics in this state. It was really important to us to make sure we reached out to underrepresented groups, traditionally underrepresented groups, and so we conducted the process in six languages: English, Spanish, Chinese, Vietnamese, Russian, and Somali, and collected information in all of those languages. And in the end, last spring, over a period of about 2 months, 10,894 Oregonians participated in Oregon Rising conversations and completing the survey that we created. And as you might imagine, we were absolutely overwhelmed by the response, especially when you consider that the way the conversation and then the survey process was designed, we had six open-ended questions in the survey process that was part of the meetings and part of the online experience. And typically when you do surveys, open-ended responses are, you know, some of the least responded to or the very, you know, quickly responded to portions of a survey. In Oregon Rising, we had six open-ended questions, and we had people doing paragraphs and sometimes pages in response to each question that we posed. And so we quickly realized that with some 60,000 responses in an open-ended fashion in those surveys, we needed some help in analyzing the responses and making sure we reported accurately on what Oregonians had to say about their schools and education they wanted for their kids. And so we hired Adam Davis from DHM Research to take a look at all of the information. And Adam, like us, was pretty blown away by the enthusiasm Oregonians showed for the ability, the opportunity to answer the question, what do you really want for your kids in their schools? And what we found is that they shared not only their minds but their hearts with us about what they really want for kids. And so I want to read a quote that Adam said right after he got the information and began to dig into it. He said, "I haven't seen anything like Oregon Rising in my 40 years of doing opinion research and public outreach across the state. It is special both for the number of Oregonians who participated and the quality of the responses." In fact, Adam told us that he's not aware of a larger public outreach effort in the history of the state. And there are some in the distant past that may come close, but it's right up there. So as we got those 10,894 responses, what Adam did was help us look at it and say, what we want to make sure we do is have a, when we report the results, we want to do it in a really demographically accurate way. So if you think about a process like this, you know, with nearly 11,000 people, and of course with the topic, many of the respondents would be teachers and administrators and classified employees of school districts, and about half of the 11,000 were. But Adam set up the analysis in a way that he took a slice of 1,800 that were very representative. So school employees are not overrepresented in the results. In fact, they're just the few percent that they are of the population at large. And the results are instead really reflective of Oregonians in almost every demographic way that you can imagine. And so there are a couple of really important takeaways from what we found. One is that it turns out that Oregonians, almost no matter how you look at that and how you slice the data, they're in remarkable agreement. What they say is the gap between what Oregon students need and what we are giving them is far too large. That's very clear. And they actually, and this is pretty remarkable, they have two top priorities that just sang through. Like if we're going to do something about this, if we're really going to make a difference for kids in the state, they identified two top priorities that they thought would most help students be successful. And I want to, before I share those with you, I just want to say, this was a completely open-ended question. It was, what are your priorities for getting the schools that you'd like for your kids, grandkids, and the kids next door? That was the question. We didn't try to, in any way, you know, set that up to get a certain answer. There wasn't a list that people picked from. It was completely open-ended. And more than two-thirds of them gave this response. They said that, this is the summary of that response, that we want to add teachers and staff to reduce class sizes and better engage and support students, meet their individual needs. So that was number one. And if you think about that a completely open-ended question would have two-thirds of people in agreement as one of their top priorities would be that's pretty remarkable. And in fact, really unprecedented in the work that Adam described that he's done in the past. The second priority, which was identified by about half of people who responded, was that they believe that we need to provide a more well-rounded education, restoring art and music, STEM and CTE, civics and culture and languages, and so much more. So it's really about providing a really well-rounded education that Oregonians think prepares kids for success in life and in whatever future endeavor they pursue. And those were really the two most remarkable takeaways. Now, there's a lot of information. You have the report summary.
This isn't reflected in that.
There's a lot of good stuff there. But those were the two key takeaways.
Well, thank you very much. Sure. I appreciate that. And I'm going to ask if folks either on the phone or in the room have questions for you.
Sure.
And why don't we start with Representative Hack?
Thank you. Thank you for this. This is great.
Absolutely.
Information. Just curious, when you look at the part that talks about the 33%, 33-29, mm-hmm. when you talk about the two-thirds, say, add teachers and staff, why is that not reflected in
what page?
In my reading, maybe this is a different. Is this just pertaining to this question, or is it overall? That's on page 7.
Okay, on page 7. This was a little different question than one I was describing.
Okay.
Yeah, but so this was just if you had, this question was, if you have a dream, what is it?
Okay.
The questions that are around priorities are a couple of pages back.
Page 10
and 11, where it's under education priorities.
Okay.
And again, completely open-ended question that asked what their priorities were, and that's where the 68% and the 50% come.
Thank you.
You bet.
Any other questions from people in the room or on the phone?
This is Hannah.
Hi, Hannah.
I just want to make sure you can hear me. I just want to say thank you to Craig and for all of the support for this endeavor.
And one of the really unique things about this project is that it's a partnership of OEA, OSBA, and COSA. And so, both Hannah and I, as well as Betsy Miller-Jones at OSBA, we often go to our national meetings and talk with our counterparts around the country. And each of us has had a similar response when we've described Oregon Rising Project. And that's, my counterparts say, We in our state, we couldn't do that. The three education organizations couldn't come together around a process like this, engage Oregonians, and then you know, move forward together based on the results.
Any other questions that we might have here for Craig? Well, this information we have on OLIS, and it also gives us, I think, some good information that we have sort of skirted around as far as, you know, who our customers are and, you know, who are the people that actually are supposed to be the experts in the field, and that should be parents.
Right.
And it should be students that are actually getting the opportunity to have the class time, as well as folks who are involved in, you know, handing out the instruction. I think it's real important for you to... for us to reiterate what you said about it being a sample of an overall, since there was such a large sampling that you were able to get down to the demographics of the state and then really work at what the population is and make sure that we've got a well-rounded group of folks that we're using in the sample itself. So that's important, I think, to note. It matters on what the methodology is. It matters on who you actually look at and get to fill out your surveys. And so I appreciate the fact that you've been very thorough in this. Any other comments about do we feel like it is represented in the work that we've done as far as we've had, you know, different folks, parents and teachers and others come in and talk to us? We have this on a list in our bibliography or in our work as far as what we've reviewed. Is there anything else you think we need to do with this report as far as our introduction or as far as any part of the report that we're going to be giving back to the legislature? Are we okay with that? Okay. Anybody else have any other comments before we move on to the next agenda item?
This is Colin from Oregon PTA on the phone. I'd like to thank Craig for putting this together and bringing this to this task force because, you know, in these small conversations that we have with schools and parents, I hear this resonated, but to see it in such a large scale, I hope carries a little bit more weight as we move forward. But thank you.
Thanks, Colin.
Thank you very much, Colin.
Craig, was there a question or any discussion about funding in this?
No, in fact, thanks, Brian, for the question. I appreciate it. We actually intentionally divorced this conversation from funding, and the reason was, honestly, people feel such fatigue around talking about budgets and where they need to cut or trim or somehow balance. And what we found as we began to put this process together is what people really welcomed is an opportunity to just dream together, share their hopes for kids in this state, and not worry about dollars. We made it clear dollars would come later, that we'd have to talk funding. Related to funding, though, what's interesting is if you really dig in, and Adam notices a bunch of people that looked at this notice, if you really dig in, what this begins to sound a lot like, Brian, and I know you'll appreciate this, is are the schools described in the quality education model. And so it's really, it's happenstance for us, but it's a happy one, as you know, because we believe in the QEM and the fact that this aligns so closely with what the QEM describes feels just kind of right to us.
Yeah. One of the other elements that I thought about as I was thinking about this particular report, and I like the link that you made to QEM because we've tried to use the QEM as the basis for our discussion in this conversation. But that is that a lot of times, you know, if you are really going to be able to work toward the best system, you've got to really figure out, as the QEM did, what that system includes. And as you point out, there's different ways to discuss it, or there's different ways to describe it. But when you have these overacted, you know, things like the survey, things like the QEM that was actually discussed and talked about with budgeting in mind, knowing clearly what it takes to get there, and even to the point where we say you have to get there or you have to explain why you can't get there, that I think, again, it just reinforces what that model might look like. And so I really appreciate the timeliness and the opportunity to think about it. And after, you know, I mean, we just received the 500-page governor's budget, and we just have, you know, recently reviewed in our own minds, I think many of us, some of the goals and also some of the challenges we have in 2017. So this seems really timely discussing it both in an open-ended way as well as a way that, that talks about what does it take to get there. So I appreciate your comment, Brian, and I also appreciate that Craig and others thought to open it up a little bit and get people to really tell you what they think. If you say, you know, what do you want for dinner, and you tell them what they want, and then, well, what can we afford tonight? I mean, those are two different conversations, but they intersect, and so it's important for us to think about both. Okay. Thank you. Yes, please.
One other thing.
And this is Representative Hack.
Thank you. You know, I love this information. This is wonderful. It's a lot of what we thought was out there, but it's good to see the broad approach. My concern is going to be, you know, until we decide to make education our number one priority, we're not going to move the dial. And I love this, and it's great, but, you know, we had $1.8 billion more in our budget in the last biennium than we do now, and we chose not to fully fund education then, which is disheartening. And so it's a bleak, it makes me sad because I think that we could do so much better. But again, it's got to be a priority. And until we do that, we can have all the conversations in the world, but we're never going to change it unless we make it the number one priority. And we have not done that, and I don't see that in the governor's budget again this time, which is saddening to me.
Representative Hack, yes. I really appreciate your comment, and so thank you. One of the things that was interesting about this project is it was intentionally aspirational because we felt like we needed to have people begin to dream a little bit again beyond what the realities are that we face every day. And this project, I think, gives us a roadmap, as QEM does, and in fact, is so complementary that we know where we want to go. One of the real benefits of this project is that as people participated in it, they became really pretty enthused about what could be possible. And so more than 6,000 of them signed up at the meetings or online to say, as this goes forward, I'm ready to raise my hand and begin to advocate and work toward the kind of schools that I'm dreaming of. And so we now have more than 6,000 Oregon Rising advocates that will be joining us as we work ultimately toward the goal, you know, whether it's this session or a few sessions down the road, to eventually get to QEM level funding, which is also the level that Oregon Rising participants described. I mean, that's really ultimately the goal.
Well, and hopefully this raises awareness, too. Representative Hack again, sorry. When you talk about the lack of facilities, too, I'm sure Darren can, you know, attest to this, that while it's well-intentioned and we want to make smaller class sizes, a lot of times the bottom line also, it's not just the state funding side, it's the lack of bond measures where communities won't step up. And I mean, I worked with a school district that hadn't passed a bond in over 30 years. So hopefully this work will also bring about kind of a new enlightened, maybe we can make some changes in our own communities and maybe get excited about that and begin to have some more of those conversations too. Because if you don't have the infrastructure to be able to have smaller class sizes, I mean, that's an entire different area that has to be tackled, and whether or not the state helps with, you know, which we have done some of the bond matches and those things, but, you know, we've got to get communities excited about education, and I think it's been a long time since they felt that way. So I think this is also going to be great for that.
Thank you very much for your comments. Is there anybody else that would like to talk about this item who's here in the audience from their organizations? Okay, thank you very much. Craig, thank you for coming in today. I really appreciate your time. Thank you. We're going to have our next presentation, and it's the Tell Oregon Survey. And we have with us Dr. Hilda Roselli, and she's with the College and Career Readiness and Education Advancement Director for Chief Education Office. It's a very long title, but a very important one. Thank you. And we appreciate you taking the time this afternoon to join us here at the task force. And I have on my list Hannah, I have Darren, okay, Jeff, Jessica, Ann, Colin, Have I missed anybody that didn't check in completely?
Gary from Pendleton.
Yes, sir. Gary.
Oh, Gary. Gary, thank you.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much. So
great. Well, thank
you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, and Chair McLean and members of this task force. For the record, my name is Hilda Roselli, and I work in the Chief Education Office. And I do have responsibilities for both policy driving around college and career readiness and educator advancement. So you can sort of see that this falls into the educator advancement bucket. I am also pleased to be able to add to your knowledge base as you move forward. This is your final meeting, I believe, for your task force. So hopefully I tried to anticipate what questions you might have about the results, and if not, I will follow up with any additional information. And I do want to acknowledge that this the TEL survey, like Oregon Promise, was a collaborative partnership that involved very close members and connections and support from Oregon Education Association, from the Confederation of School Administrators, from the Oregon School Boards Association, from the Chalkboard Project, and the Oregon School Personnel Association, and others, and of course the Oregon Department of Education and our office. So it truly was a collaborative process. Just a couple of what it is and what it is not. This, first of all, the TEL itself, in case you're wondering, that is an acronym, and it does stand for Teaching, Empowering, Leading, and Learning. So you can see why we call it the TEL survey. And it is something that was developed by the New Teacher Center and developed for use in a number of other states as well as our own. And so we very much abide by the guidelines of administration of the survey so that we can feel confident about the reliability and validity of the results. These items are very well researched with the basis for why they are worded the way they are. And even at our begging, they will not easily change an item because it really could construe the reliability of the instrument. In Oregon, this survey was first administered in 2014 and then again in 2016. And because this is a volunteer survey and it is anonymous, it really allows educators to weigh in on their perceptions around teaching and working conditions. And I would just remind us that the literature has actually looked lately at perceptional data. And, you know, I think for a while it was viewed as less valid when it was anonymous. And yet it truly is a perception. It is a reflection of the perception that people hold about their own realities. And that's why we felt it was a very important piece to be able to offer. There are eight areas that are measured in the survey, and each of these constructs has a number of questions that hang with this particular topic, whether it be teacher leadership or use of time. The reason I'm pointing this out is that class size fell into the use of time. And I will share with you just a little bit of information about not only the item on class size, but also how people answered in response to the other items in that construct. In terms of 2016, we were very pleased. I'm, you know, looking at the 11,000 on this last presentation, we're very pleased with having over 18,000 respondents. That represents 54% of those who would be eligible to complete the survey. And I want to be clear that this did not include school district personnel. This is based solely to ask teachers and school-based professionals. So it does include principals and assistant principals, but it does not include district personnel. And the nice thing is that you can go online and pull off the data results for administrators versus teachers. So that gives you a better sense. This slide shares with you the how the breakout was in terms of teachers. There were 16,651 who responded, and that was 91% of those who answered the survey. So it really is a valid way of saying this represents a large contingency of teachers over any other group. In terms of principals, we had 353, 2%. Assistant principals, 1% at 192. And other staff who would be things like school social workers and school psychologists who are also based at the school, that represented 1,070. In comparison, I just want to give you a quick way to look at how those numbers compared. In 2014, we had a slightly higher response rate of over 19,373 people, and that represented about 59.4% compared to 54%. And I will just share with you that we already have plans for 2018, when we hope again to administer the survey, because the beauty of it is to have a baseline and to keep monitoring to see whether or not the investments made by the state and legislators are paying off in a way that is reflected in the responses by educators. I thought it might be helpful for you to just see the school levels that were represented here. The majority of those responding were elementary school based, but we still had a significant number of responses from high schools and indeed middle school. Special education programs were slightly underrepresented in this particular analysis. I thought it'd be helpful for you to know how did we reach the findings. So for every item, the percentage of respondents who answered they agree or strongly agree determined how we reported that data on. This is this shows how educators are responding to this. In terms of the construct, however, it was looking at the number of items and actually combining 4 out of 5 to get a construct average. I think personally, in this particular item, because there was only one question dealing with class size, I would caution you not to use the construct as much as you would use the actual response to the item. So here is your actual response in 2016 to the question of whether or not people agree or disagree with the statement, class sizes are reasonable, such that teachers have the time available to meet the needs of all students. And what we see is that 23%, or 4,167 people, strongly disagreed. 40%, or 7,258, disagreed. 28%, or 5,073, agreed. 9%, or 1,630, strongly agreed. For purposes of reporting, we shared that this meant that 37%, or 6,703, agreed or strongly agreed that this statement, that they agreed with this statement. And of course, if you do your math, you can see that the overwhelming number, 63%, either disagreed or strongly disagreed. I thought it would be very helpful for you to look at a few other states and how other states responded to this particular item. So I have pulled results from North Carolina, where they had a whopping 100,348 educators respond to their 2016 survey. And in this case, it's almost opposite of what we found in Oregon. 62% of the educators in North Carolina agreed with the statement that class size was such that they had time available to meet the needs of all students.
Can I ask a question about that? If you're comparing the two states, what were their class sizes?
I did not pull that information. It would be an average at best. that I'd be able to provide for you, but I can certainly follow up and find that out for
you. Well, that would be the only way that the comparison would work for me, because if you're going to make a comparison, then I'd be hoping you'd be comparing with folks that have like class sizes.
Yes, so we'd be looking at average to average, so we could certainly go with that. And Brian, maybe you could work with me on preparing that and getting that back to you. All right? Just to look at the other states, Tennessee's data I included next because they also had a very sizable response rate of 59,000 plus folks, but that was in 2013, and their response was 68% agreement with that statement. Kentucky gave their survey last in 2015, and 70% of their 44,607 educators who responded agreed with the statement. And then lastly, Colorado, which administered a survey in 2015, 60% of the individuals. So I think it's just important there to look and see there was quite a dramatic difference between those other four states, but we will follow up and provide you with the averages for the state class size.
Is somebody online?
Hilda?
Yes.
Yeah, sorry, this is Ann. I have a follow-up question. I mean, based on the research that our work task force did earlier, those states have significantly smaller class sizes than what are common in Oregon, as well as the information that even between 2014 in Oregon and 2016 in Oregon. Do you feel like there's a correlation that we've been able to easily see between those two states?
Well, as I said, I think we'll provide you with our best information on the state average class size in those states, and that will give you the last piece of the equation. I will also say that just between 2014 and 2016, which I'm going to show you next, we could actually see the results that as budgets improved and schools invested those dollars in reducing class sizes and hiring more educators, it's very possible, there's certainly a correlation. I'm not going to say it's causal, but there's a correlation between how people responded to the item. So, Anna, I think that the follow-up on the state averages will be the next step that we can send you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Hannah.
Representative Hack here.
Yes. I'm here.
Okay, thank you.
When you look at 2014, and we were at 25, in 2016, 37, same question on this survey. So we increased by 12. What were the class sizes in 2014 and the class sizes in 2016? Do you know?
I did not prepare that information for you, but again, I will work with Brian Reeder. Our office doesn't tabulate those data, but we can certainly provide
I'm
that
just curious
you.
If class sizes...
Brian, do you happen to know that off the top?
I don't know off the top of my head. I do know that we added a lot of teachers in 2015-16 relative to the prior couple of years.
So if we're... I mean, if teachers... I guess this is a little conflicting to me in that teachers are saying it's much better than what it was. I mean, 12 is significant, but then you look at the rise... And that's not the case. So it's just, I'm trying to wrap my head around, okay? So.
Well, I do think that you saw improvement in terms of the budgets for school districts. So that certainly didn't surprise me that we saw a higher percentage of teachers say that they agreed with the statement when districts were able to hire again. We saw it in terms of just the supply and demand of new teachers that suddenly there was a demand for new teachers because of those additional budget dollars. But I still believe that you're seeing an overall lower satisfaction than with other states, dramatically different. And again, when we get those state averages for you, that'll help.
Yeah.
I agree with Representative Hack that, I mean, that we need to make sure we know what the variables were in all of the states, and that we need to make sure we understand what the variables were in Oregon between 2014 and 2016. We didn't just add budget. We added teachers, as you point out.
Yes.
I mean, there were thousands of teachers hired back. And so it's important for us to take in, I think, all the variables and think about it. But what I do like about both of these studies is one of us gave a overall systems approach, parents, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. students, teachers, administrators. This talks about the practitioner and talks about the satisfaction of the practitioner in the classroom that year. And there could be a lot of variables that we need to be checking on. But again, it gives a very different perspective than the first one on Oregon Rising. So as long as we understand what data you're looking at and what comparisons you're making, then I think we can decide what we, you know, what we gain from that. Mm-hmm. But it is important in my mind that if we're going to be talking about comparisons between other states, look at the budgets in the other states. I mean, mm-hmm. what I care about is what Oregonians think about Oregonian, you know, about Oregon schools and what we can do to continue the improvement in those institutions. So I'm not as curious about the other states unless we're going to make sure that all the sideboards and variables and criteria are matching in a way that they're useful for us reading this report. So I think whatever we can do to make
we'll
that happen.
We'll certainly provide you with all of that information
okay.
and then...
And we won't interrupt you again. Yes. Yes.
This is Hannah.
Hi, Hannah.
We did a lot of research about the TEL survey before we took on advocating to do it, and then we have had so much luck in being able to use that data to have conversations about the realities in our schools. And in regards to class size, our agreement percentage was so much lower than any other state. I believe the lowest other state was above 50%. So, and we're the third largest class size. That's what the data is going to bear out on that. And it does have an impact on educators' ability to meet the needs of their students. And I think that's one of the things that they've been, that our members across the state have been crying out for, and the administrators who filled out this in the same way. We have to address this issue in order to make sure that educators can provide that differentiated instruction. Research-based survey, so if anybody needs further information about all of the work that's gone into creating the TEL survey, we can actually, I'm sure that Hilda can get that for everyone.
Thank you so much.
So just a couple of last slides here. This was the comparison for 14 and 16 in terms of responses, as Representative Hack already noted. And then lastly, I provided you with a slide of some of the other key items in this construct. And the reason being that class size definitely impacts teachers' ability to meet the needs of every student in their classroom, but there are other elements around the use of time that this particular construct identifies and measures. And so I've included four other items here. Teachers' class sizes are reasonable such that teachers have time available to meet the needs of all students, and then they break that out separately with sufficient instructional time. And two others that are rather interesting is how non-instructional time impacts the ability of teachers to work with students, and even including things such as routine paperwork and how that impacts teachers' use of time. There were two other items in that area, in that construct. Minimal interruptions, and 60% of the teachers agreed that they had the time available to focus on educating students without minimal interruptions. And the other one was they are protected from duties that interfere with their essential role of educating students. 71% agreed with that. But I would point out that in 2014, through much of the efforts of partners for the TEL survey, that districts that were very effective in beginning to unpack these results, as Hannah mentioned, began to have dialogues about, oh, you mean every time we interrupt the class with an intercom, that's making a difference in your ability to keep kids on focus and moving forward in instruction. And so those kinds of conversations are the valuable part of using perceptual data. It's not just looking at the numbers. And so I would really invite members of the task force to look at the website that is listed, available through the handout that I provided, because you can then also see examples that have been posted around specific school districts and how they are using these results. So that may be of help to you as you complete your report. And as I mentioned, we'll be right on following up to get you the data that you wanted to make even more sense of these pieces.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the report and some of the dialogue and comments and questions that this has brought forward. I was in two third grade classrooms yesterday, and with different needs and different demographics of students and different support systems. And again, it's looking at the whole dialogue. And I think what this task force has said more than once, that there's this integration of the class size, because it's important to understand that the teacher has to have the opportunity for, as Hannah said, the differentiation of instruction to a wide variety of students in the classroom. And so it's looking at all of these other things. Of course, the other items are going to make a difference, because then that also takes away from the planning that goes into differentiation.
And time for collaboration with colleagues as
Absolutely.
Well, which was another item. I would also suggest that if you find it useful, we could provide you, working with Brian, we could pull out results for this particular item on those school districts that have the highest class size for the district. Or we could even break that down by school, because we have all of the school data, and compare it to those who have the lowest class size in either the school or the district.
That sounds like Brian's getting two extra jobs. And
no, all he would need to do is send me one data file, if you have it, by class size. Is it by district?
I have those files already constructed by
okay.
district.
Then we would do the analysis for that item for you.
I think that sounds interesting. I think that sounds like work that we would all be interested in. And I'm not sure we can wait on that analysis before we have to finish this work, but I think it can basically impact and or, you know, be useful to us in the future as we go forward. And it might even be something that we can use in some suggestions. But certainly, we're not
Your
going
timeline
to,
for the report is
well,
this
we're,
month?
We're on borrowed time.
Okay.
And we're trying to get this, you know, returned to the legislature. And we agreed to meet some extra meetings. So, Cheyenne, what's our turnaround?
Madam Chair, members of the task force, hopefully you were going to walk through the report and
today.
Agree to its finalization and further
yeah.
steps if there were any today. The task force sunsets the end of this month, or it may be mid-month.
It's the end of December that we can still function.
You can always supplement the record at a later date, so there's no crunch on people who are offering to provide additional information. We can upload to OLIS and later link to the report, so long as everybody agrees now that that's what you want to do. Whatever's provided can be uploaded and linked in an appendix to the report at a later time, and just be pending up until then.
Well, I'm going to ask others. I mean, I think it's important to always, you know, agree to take in more information if we think it's useful. The information sounds useful. But Hannah and others, I would ask you to look at the information and look at the dialogue, and that if we're going to add that to the report as, you know, an extra a little bit later, we should also have members of the task force responses to whatever the analysis is. So if we have the opportunity to do that, I think that it's reasonable. What do you folks think? Is that agreed? Okay. Everybody on the phone okay with this? Hopefully you're still there. Okay. Thank you. Is that Jeff?
Yes, I'm good.
Okay. Everybody else okay?
Yeah, okay.
Okay. Thank you, Hannah.
Gary, fine.
Thank you.
Yeah, Colin, this is fine.
Thank you. Okay. All right. That sounds great. Thank you so much. I appreciate your time today.
Oh, absolutely. And I'll be following up with Brian probably by the time he gets back to his office.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. At this time, you guys, and those of you that are on the phone, are you able to see the written work up on the screen?
We'll get it up.
What we're going to put up next is we're going to look at the suggested amendments that you folks suggested in the last meeting that Cheyenne has put up. And I've asked Cheyenne to go through these one by one so that we can give a nod or ask questions if we don't believe she captured what we were saying. So at this time, we're going to turn to the hard work, and we'll ask Cheyenne to go forward with the first suggestion. Can you see it on the screen, you guys? Okay, if there's any question, then please feel free to recognize yourself, and please go forward with questions. And Cheyenne's going to start at the top.
Madam Chair, members of the task force, this document that's up on the screen right now with all of the blue, what was redlining in the report that I sent out, went out to all the task force members and some of the interested persons 2 weeks ago, approximately 2 weeks ago. These are the changes that were made after the task force meeting on the 21st, trying to capture the discussion that day, and left in a track changes form in case anybody didn't want to incorporate them, or like you said, they don't adequately capture. So hopefully everybody's had a chance to look at them. And then I prepared a summary. You're running the, you're scrolling up and down on the document on the screen. Did you mean to do that?
No, I didn't. I thought I watched this way, so that's all good. I thought you had control of it there. My apologies.
That's all right. If you wanted to look at a particular part of it, I've just gone down to the first set of changes, and I summarized the changes that were made in a narrative in the email that went out to everybody. The total number of meetings has been changed to include through this date, the current date. The open discussion part of your activities was also included in the description of task force activities. In the summary, this section here, task force findings and recommendations, replaced a previous section which listed these QEM recommended class sizes. These are repeated in the fuller text of the report. And I didn't know what people would want to do if the recommendations were more important to include in this executive summary. It's limited to 2 pages. And since there was repetition with the class size numbers, I just edited it that way. It can be altered. But since it's only 2 pages, task force recommendations replaced, or suggested recommendations replaced, these numbers which appear later. Then there were 2 new sections in the report that were described. The conclusion section and findings and recommendations which were developed at the last meeting. And then there was a correction to the description of the Chief Education Office's chronic absenteeism report. It was previously in this report, it was previously described, the absenteeism report was described as resulting from a piece of legislation. But it didn't result from that piece of legislation. It wasn't legislatively mandated. So I just made that correction, and the report issued on the first of this month. It was due, the absenteeism report that is a result of House Bill 4002. So we could link to that, and that's reflected later in the report. And the rest of it remains the same. Oh, and then including the reporting requirements. So most of these are relatively conforming changes that were made. The biggest was that switch, taking out the class sizes from the 2-page executive summary, since they're repeated in the report, and putting the findings and recommendations in there. And this is the correction of the House Bill 4002, explained here. Mm-hmm. Since it's issued, since these changes were made, it can be hyperlinked now and included as an appendix or a supplement.
Mm-hmm. And that's good.
So those are the changes that were made, and they're in blue here. And then if in track changes, when you accept all the changes, I sent out a second document, which was simply the clean copy, with everything in blue from the previous document, accepted and changed for ease of a read-through if anybody wanted a report to read through. And this would serve, if you accept all the changes, this serves as the current document to edit with anything new coming from the members or feedback coming today. And there are already a couple of additional changes in this.
Right. Does anybody have any questions for Cheyenne, or did anybody in reviewing have any specific area that you were not clear on as far as the change? We have a couple of other changes that have come in from members.
That's correct.
We also have had a subgroup
met
that was talking about what we would consider to be current service level, and we have had a few folks comment on that. And so I don't know if anybody who commented on that wants to make some oral comments or explain their considerations, that would be fine. Darren, did you have something you want to say on that?
Sure. I think you have in front of you an email that came back from the Oregon Association of School Business Officials, and their belief is the roll-up cost, for lack of a better term, is shown here to be, where does it show down here at the bottom? Around $8.4 billion instead of what we received from the legislature and or what we got from the governor's budget earlier this year. Those business officials arrived from a different perspective, but mostly about, I think Richard mentioned before the meeting started, about how the money gets spent rather than what they believe the roll-up costs are, and this email kind of lines out their assumptions along the way. Does that help?
Yes, I mean that's a good start, and I think everybody got a copy of this in their email, and it was just recently for those of you that are on the phone, and so it could have come in today. I don't know if you actually saw it yet.
Madam Chair, yes. We've posted it on OLIS as well, so the folks on the phone can pull it up off of the legislative website if they need to, if they haven't accessed
it. If you don't have it, it's on OLIS already, and it has basically 9 assumptions or comments that are being made by this group that brought this forward to us. And as we've been told by other staff and by other organizations, when our legislative LFO is looking at it, they're making one assumption with certain sideboards that deal with anything from, what's the roll-up for the next year going to be? And they're looking at possibly an average, and they're looking at all of the districts and looking at some sideboards that they've given themselves on what is that school, just like QEM looks at some of the schools with a certain size for elementary, middle, and high school, and then what that would change staffing needs, and that would also change some of the needs for particular schools that have particular programs that they have utilized and plan on going forward with in the next year. So there is a difference on what is that roll-up cost and what is that service level. And we talked about that and the importance of that in this report. So I'm asking you to reflect on the subcommittee's work and also what you want to do with this service level discussion in this report.
Do we have these assumptions here? Are a little vague. Some of them they talk about biennial, and others they talk about per year, and others they don't say which. So do we have the details of all of their calculations somewhere?
So Darren, I would turn to you on this, or to Rich.
I think that the Oregon Association of School Business Officials could get that. I'm fairly certain by looking at some of the numbers, though Brian, you deal with this far more than I do. Some of these are vague for sure. Some are not quite as vague as they seem to be. Number 4, for example, 3% increase on salaries is what all the superintendents were talking about for the upcoming year on average.
That's the year.
Mm-hmm. That's a year kind of thing.
Yeah,
I think Brian's right with regard to, can we get some of these details mm-hmm. laid out that would make a little more sense? And I'm fairly certain that we can get that information
I'm also going to ask Rich to come and join us at the table and also give a few comments. And, Darren, I appreciate that.
Okay. He'll know more about it than I will.
Sure. So introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee task force. My name is Richard Donovan. I work for the Oregon School Boards Association. Until a short while ago, I was a committee staffer on this committee, too. So that's out in the open. The email, I was CC'd on the email that the chair is referencing, and that's on OLIS. It was sent by Angie Peterman, who is from the Oregon School, OASBO, Oregon Association of School Business Officials. To Brian's question, and kind of generally, the Office of the Legislative Fiscal Office and OASBO are working now, talking about their different assumptions. And I asked Angie for a memo or something more formal for kind of just such an occasion, mm-hmm. and they do not, they're not ready. They're not for prime time. It was, okay. was kind of her phrase. I can talk you through. I have seen the LFO kind of calculation, and I have seen with Angie where her points of contention. So, for example, the 2% roll-up cost that comes from a 10-year average, looking backward, that you, I believe, Brian, sent to LFO. That's kind of a standard calculation. Looking backwards, the projected increase in staff calculation, in cost, excuse me, teacher salary increases, is 2%. That's the number that LFO uses.
But that's not just a 10-year average. That's based on a much more complicated model that looks at staff turnover and so forth.
I certainly defer to your expertise on this. But just to be the guy who's kind of carrying the water here, Angie, who I believe is also expert, and the association she represents, think that there are better models, and as I understand, or different calculations or whatever. She and Doug and other folks, Doug Wilson from LFO, are kind of trying to get to the best model. And they believe, the Oregon, OASBO, believes that 8.4 is closer to being the accurate number. $8.4 billion is closer to being the accurate number in terms of what will actually represent to districts the amount of money that will allow them to avoid a cuts budget.
So I have a comment to make as chair. I think we have three choices as far as this report's going. We have a number that's in the QEM. We have a number that we get from LFO. We have a number that has been suggested to us by folks that deal with these budgets on a daily basis. And so we can either put in the QEM number, which was the original number. We can put in a range between the numbers that have been suggested to us, or we could have a placeholder. And the fourth choice would be that if we're not going to use the QEM and we're not going to use the range, that we simply acknowledge that there are different opinions on what the roll-up cost is going to be on a yearly basis at the present time. And so I just want to have in the report, you know, what is the most useful.
And I'm stepping up to give this background information. Again, Brian has forgotten more about this kind of thing than I'll probably ever know. But I understand that the subgroup of this task force met and kind of settled on, made some determination, and that's how I understand the background of that determination to be.
Well, I mean, is there a compelling reason we need to talk about the current service level in this report?
That's a question that I think I asked last time and I'm asking this time. I think the reason for looking at the current service level was to reflect on the QEM to make sure it was still a valid document as far as the basic figures and the basic concepts about what we needed to actually implement the QEM. So I don't think I think it's a reasonable piece of information for us to look at, a reasonable situation for us to, you know, to put into context. So I'm asking for guidance here because that we know that number is going to change. And I think what we were trying to do was recognize that looking at the QEM, we should be relating to it in a way that we're being fair on what it really does take to actually, because of the language of the QEM responsibilities of the legislature, which is either to fund it or to tell why we can't. Well, we've got to have a reasonable suggested number to be able to do that.
Well, I guess my thought is that, as Richard said, OASBO is not ready for prime time, so I don't know how we can embrace their number when we don't know how they got it.
Can we acknowledge the conversation?
Sure. I mean, this.
This is Hannah. When you're ready.
Yes, Hannah. Please.
I guess one of the reasons why I think it's important to look at and to acknowledge the OASBO number is, I believe it has been an issue that we've had about what the actual roll-up cost is. It's been shortchanged, and it's going to impact what we're looking at as a starting point for public education K-12. And it's my belief that their number is closer than what is being used by others, and we should use the most accurate number that we have available. So I would look for us to continue to evaluate the number that they have, get the people, get the Department of Ed, whoever's sitting down with OASBO, let's make sure we have the right number because our kids are depending on it.
Anybody else have a comment on this issue?
I guess my comment is that I think you made a good point about coming up with a range that acknowledges what the legislative office did. While I agree that it is too low, I know that when I break that down from my district, it is too low. That number is too low. It's simply not going to cover my roll-up costs. So I suppose there could be other folks out there that the number is too high. I haven't met any of them, but I, you know, as a superintendent, maybe they're hedging their bets a little bit. So the idea of sharing the number that came out of the legislative office and the number that attaches to the QEM and to OASBO's work is there. Maybe something we can share all across the board and acknowledge that there are differences in the number. That's probably the most transparent way to do this work. At the same time, I don't know of a superintendent or a district that doesn't go to its business manager and say, can we get this done? Mm-hmm. So I agree that Brian's right. The number has to be flushed out. The number has to be, and the information has to be gathered at a deeper level if I'm going to put my name to this document. However, I do believe the number is probably higher than that.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, to just to dovetail off of that.
And say your name.
Richard Donovan, again, from the Oregon School Boards Association. I think the idea of a range is spectacular, and I think the reason that this sort of thing is important is because, and again, you know, chime in, maybe I'm wrong about this, but current service level kind of is almost a term of art at this point in time, and so people say current service level. If you say current service level, you can hear the governor's budget projected current service level, current service level projected by LFO, which has to deal with last year's biennial process, current service level as calculated by OASBO. And so even just in terms of transparency of terms and kind of like what's up on the screen now, current service level identified in the governor's budget, just that type of specificity would be useful.
So, Hannah, what do you think about the idea that the report is making a suggestion that this number needs to be discussed and that there is a range out there and that the dialogue is important? How about some language like that in the report? With a range, who's been involved, what those, you know, what the definition is from those organizations, LFO.
Yeah, I think that's fine, and I think the ultimate goal is just ensure that we have the right number as we do the work. And so to have the state and the business leaders from the districts come together and really talk about how we come up with that right number, I'd be great with that. So thank you for that idea.
So we could put this in our conclusion, that there's a range, and we could put down the range and who the range came from. And then we can put down the comment that we think is extraordinarily important that we have the right numbers so we know we can do the quality education model, that we can actually do it.
Madam Chair, I'm in the section right now on that discusses current service levels. And it was pending some additional suggested language at some point.
So what we're asking for is a range here.
Well, here's what I would recommend then, if we're going to do that. The way the quality ed model works is it starts with the current service level and then says, how much more do we need to get the schools we really want? And so if you're going to say, I don't remember what the current service level estimate coming out of LRO and DAS is, but what you want to do is to say, if this is the current service level, then the QEM is $1.9 billion more than that. And if the current service level is higher, then the QEM is $1.9 billion higher than that number. So the QEM is always that $1.9 billion more than wherever you decide the correct current service level is.
Okay, and I think we all agreed to that.
Okay.
And is that, Madam Chair, is that what's reflected in this descriptive paragraph?
No.
Okay.
And so that's what we're changing. And so I think Cheyenne would feel more comfortable if we would send to her in an email form that language for acknowledging that there is a range on what the current service level is, giving that range and who those numbers came from, and then acknowledging, as Brian said, that whatever the current service level is, which we need to continue to work on to make sure we have a good number, that the quality education model would be $1.9 billion higher than that. Richard or Hannah or someone, would you be willing to send, Hannah, would you be willing to send that to Cheyenne?
Say that one more time,
send her just that language which acknowledges the two numbers, acknowledges where they came from, and then acknowledges that if we were to do the quality education model, it would be $1.9 billion higher than the accepted number.
And Madam Chair, if this is not accurate, it can be struck. I'm not sure where this... The paragraph we're looking at right now, cost to reduce class sizes to recommended levels, where they're discussing, based on current service levels, the amount is $361 million for elementary schools. How that would be affected? That's what's in the report, the QEM, correct?
The QEM, the impacts of going from current service level to full QEM, that gap part, is not affected by where we decide the proper current service level is. It's always an addition to the current service level. So all the $1.992 billion funding gap, that's an accurate number. The 361 is an accurate number.
So this existing paragraph, even if I remove this language, as identified, the qualifying language right here can be removed?
Yeah. I mean, I you know,
discussion.
Even putting some language in there that says, you know, there is disagreement about what the roll-up, you know, the current service level is, in other words, the cost of rolling up. But independent of where it is, the additional resource to fully fund the QEM is this amount.
And I think we've said that, and I think we're agreeing with that. So it's just either after the meeting, one of us needs to write it down so that we can put it in there so we have the range, where the numbers came from, and that there is a disagreement or there is a discussion or a dialogue that is important to continue till we get to the current service level or number. Are we, everybody on the phone okay with this?
Yep. Yep.
Okay. So is there any other amendments that were turned in this week that we need to go over now?
I've got a couple things that
okay.
I came across. It's on page 6 talking about the class sizes.
Okay.
Not that. The one where it says, for example, 82% of K-1 students are in classes with more than 20 students.
There you go.
When you get down to the middle and high school, those are all core classes. That issue came up with, I had an email from, I don't remember.
So starting here, 95% of 6 through 8 have at least one core class?
Yes.
The description of core classes?
Core class, yes.
And that goes all the way down. Is that correct?
Yeah. I think that I had an email from Paula or Ann, one or the other, asking that question.
Okay.
And the answer is, yeah, those are, that's the way I calculated those.
Okay.
Is this core class. Otherwise, you get marching band.
Yeah.
That puts every music student in a class of 150.
Yeah. That's a good marching band.
That's a good marching band. Okay. And so then next we have.
We received a suggestion from Ann, and she had to disconnect for a meeting and hopes to call back.
Yes.
To insert a line on page 12. Let's see if I can go right to it. Which I've highlighted here because I made the suggestion in advance. She suggested right here, because no research exists on class sizes as large as those in Oregon, comma, and then the remainder of the paragraph. The task force did not see direct evidence. That was her suggestion.
Well, I would agree with that because we went through some dialogue, but they were in classes in the 90s, and they were out of state. Some of them were out of state. And so I think that's good language. And is there anybody that would disagree with that, or can we add that language, please?
Is it more accurate to say no current research exists? Because you did say there's something about research from the 90s.
Yeah. But
I can go either way.
No current research. But, okay, that's fine. If they bring up old research, we can talk about how large the size is. They were like 25. Is everybody okay with that on the phone?
Yep. Yep.
Okay. Next we have.
Madam Chair, members of the task force, the only other additions, which weren't included here, is you alluding at the previous meeting to having a discussion today about how and whether or not to capture in this report anything that had to do with the discussion about the pending report on Senate Bill 1541, if you wanted to include a paragraph summarizing that discussion from the last meeting and how to do that. And then any comments that the members wanted to make about handouts they looked at that were submitted at the last meeting. We just didn't, there wasn't an opportunity for discussion if anybody had anything they wanted to add.
The first one on, I believe it was Senate Bill 1541, we know that that report is out now.
No, it's not.
It's not out.
15th. December 15th.
15th, so it's just a week from now. Okay, so does anybody want to put in this report that we should relate to, look at, anything you want to do about 1541. We know that 1541 was dealing with how money is spent.
Correct.
And we've talked about how we want to be dreamers and we want to make sure we understand what a good quality education model is and that that is sometimes not related to the dollars when we're looking at what that looks like. So is there anybody who wants to put a reference to this other Senate bill report that's coming out on the 15th? Or do we want to just let it be a standalone and we go forward? What do you want to do about it?
And again, this is something that could be hyperlinked later once it's issued as part of an appendix that lists information and resources. It could be included there and could just add it if everybody agrees.
Brian, do you have a thought?
Well, I think a reference to it makes sense. The difficulty is that it's not available yet. Yeah. And so
what about in the conclusion that we acknowledge Senate Bill 1541's report is coming out on December 15th, 2016, and we're going to put in the appendix that there'll be a hyperlink that you can read it and you can give us some thoughts in the future on how it relates to this report.
Right, and maybe mention that the bill itself explicitly mentions class size as one of the issues to explore.
Okay.
This is Hannah. I know we got a little update on the report. I would be interested in seeing the report before we put it in to make sure that it's something that will be helpful for our report.
Okay, so how are we going to do that legally? Can we just can we leave a spot for it that just simply, you know, and then if anybody has any desires to put it in, then you've got to email the chair and Cheyenne.
Or you could handle it, Madam Chair, the way you suggested. Current service level discussion, that language gets submitted, it can be circulated electronically via email so that people have a chance to respond.
Okay.
Perhaps, as Hannah does, there's an opportunity to respond.
Right.
Included as a hyperlink. You can indicate in the report that the task force talked about it, and
that we want to look at it before we include it. Let's do it that way, that we talked about it, we want to look at it before we include it, but it's available as a standalone report. Hannah and others, I suggested that this language, the service level language that's going to be put in here that we suggested, is going to be sent out to you so you can look at it. And then we're not going to have another meeting, but we can give comments both to the chair and to Cheyenne, and we can also do an email exchange to make sure that the language is correct in the way we want to see it. Is that okay?
Sounds good to me.
Okay.
Yeah, that sounds good to me too.
And the only reason I suggest that is because both Representative Hack and Ann have had other meetings that they're having to go to, and I want to make sure that they have an opportunity to look at it as well. Does that sound fair? Okay.
Yes, that's good for me. Do you want me to send you something, or you're going to send us?
I would really like, Hannah, for you to send something to Cheyenne. I think she wanted a little bit more guidance, although we've written quite a bit down in the way of notes.
Okay, Cheyenne, if you send me the notes you have, I'll look at the notes I have, and then I'll come up with something and send it back to you.
All right.
Thank you, Hannah.
You're welcome.
Okay, that is the end of the amendments that I know about. And we've looked at all the reports that we agreed to look at three meetings ago. And we've had, I think, some additions made to the conclusions of the report. And so when we get the service level language and the Senate Bill 1541 language out to all members and interested parties, then we're going to send out a clean version of this, and we're asking everybody to review it word by word and then to send back by email your agreement that this is the report that we want to send out. Everybody okay with that?
Nope. Sounds great. Yep, sounds fine.
And Madam Chair, members of the task force, if I could reiterate, this would be a reply to the chair with a CC to me, and not as a group. If we're following best practices, we're not a legislative committee, but the task forces try to follow the committee model. And if you have a quorum having a group discussion, that needs to be part of a public record that's recorded the way these meetings are. So just, we can send it out, asking for your responses. When you reply to the chair with perhaps a CC to me, and that will cover that, and you'll be all right.
Is everybody okay on that?
That makes sense.
Yep.
Okay, so you will get something from Cheyenne. It will come to you, everybody, and then you guys please respond to my email and a copy to Cheyenne, and we'll go forward from there. Oh, and my gosh. The big deal is, you guys, we got an offer from the Senate Committee on Education to present this during legislative days. So we're really trying to turn this around. And, you know, that's not a bad thing to get the Senate asking to see what we're working on. And so we're going to turn this around just as quickly as we can. And then you guys can get on with Christmas shopping or anything else you do or anything else you celebrate in December. Does that sound fair?
That's good.
Okay, so we're going to turn this around just as absolutely quickly as possible. We have Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday next week, I believe, is legislative days, and that committee is on
Tuesday.
And so I promised them I would at least come and say hello and let them know a little bit about what we're doing. So it would be nice if we had something that was close to being a final report. All right. Well, you folks, thank you so much for spending a little time with us on this wonderful Tuesday afternoon.
Thank you.
Okay. And at this time, everybody, unless there's any final comments for the good of the order, we are going to conclude our task force meeting for the day. Thank you. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you. The meeting is adjourned.